I will introduce our speaker, Geta Leonard. You can see him on both screens.
Hi, I'm Leonard, your speaker seeker. And tonight our speakers are zooming in from Washington State. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to our first speaker, Matt.
Thanks, Leonard. This is Matt Fields, alcoholic. Can somebody tell me how much time we have? I don't know if we're on track, if I need to cut it short.
Both of you have 30 minutes each, and I'll give you a 5-minute warning.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you guys for inviting us, and thank you for inviting AA to participate in your anniversary celebration. And happy birthday to all the people celebrating recovery today. My wife and I have been doing this journey together for quite a while, and bringing families together in recovery is really something that's near and dear to our heart. My sobriety date is 10/30/01, and that gives me 21 years as of a couple of days ago. If you shake my family tree, what we have is suicide and alcoholic and drug deaths all over the place. I don't think that makes me alcoholic, but it didn't help. I remember my grandpa telling me early on when I was drinking in my teenage years, warning me about alcoholism. And I remember thinking specifically, well, if it gets that bad, I'll just quit. I don't know why you guys don't quit, but I'll just quit. Having no understanding of what he was trying to explain to me. And my life moved on, and I drank. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. Our book tells us that it is injurious, but we seem to not recall with sufficient force a day, a week, or even a month ago, the last debacle. And I'm ready to drink again because I love the effect produced by alcohol. It eliminates my irritable, restless, and discontent. And I didn't know that. I thought I was just drinking to have a good time. My first marriage, my wife did not appreciate my drinking, and so that marriage didn't last. I continued to drink. I was probably in my late 20s, and Sheree and I hooked up. We had been friends when we were growing up, and we reconnected. And when we reconnected, I was a late stage chronic alcoholic. And I'll just tell you a little bit about my last few months of drinking. My stomach was hurting, and she finally convinced me to go to the doctor. I thought maybe my ulcer was acting up. And when we were in the hospital, the doctor diagnosed me with pancreatitis and told her that I would maybe live 2 or 3 more months if I continued to drink the way I was drinking. And I was 33 years old. And for me, that sounded like good news. I was at that point drinking just to survive. I know that most of you probably won't understand that coming from the other perspective. But for me, I would get up in the morning almost every morning for the last several years, and I'd be brushing my teeth and gagging over the sink. And I would be promising myself that I'm not going to drink that day. And I don't know about you, but there's no one else in the room. I'm only promising myself. So I don't know why I can't seem to keep these promises, but about 11 or 12 or 1 o'clock that day, I renegotiate with myself, and I tell myself, you know what? What I really meant to decide was that I'm not going to drink as much today as I did yesterday. And so I would go about my day and have a drink at lunch or grab some alcohol on the way home. And then And then I don't realize it, but it's late in the evening again. And I'm drunk again. And I'm passing out again. And I have to sleep fast because it's 2 or 3 in the morning. And I got to get up at 5 or 6 to go to work. And now I'm gagging again in the bathroom, telling myself I'm not going to drink today. I was never promising to not drink. I just said I wasn't going to drink today. That had been going on for a long time. So when the doctor gave me a diagnosis that I wasn't going to live anymore, I thought that was pretty good news because I did not see a way out of that trap. I couldn't even keep a promise to myself. Right about that time, my wife and my dad did a little mini intervention on me. I worked for my dad, which is the only reason I was willing to listen to him at all. And my wife and my dad talked to me, and my dad walked me out to the lawn outside, and it was just him and I for a minute. And he turned to me and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "Matt, I can't lose another son." And I don't know why that was the time, because many people had cried about my drinking by that point. But something about my dad crying and telling me he was concerned about losing a son made me realize for maybe the first time that my drinking was affecting someone other than me. And I said, "Okay, what do you guys want me to do?" And he walked me back up to the house. My wife's there, Cherie, and they say they want me to go to treatment. And I said, "Well, where do you want me to go?" And my wife was a good pre-Al-Anon. She had researched the treatment center. She had them color-coded. There was 5 to pick from. And I'll let her tell more about her side of that. But for me, I picked the color I like best because I don't waste a lot of time on information. And I made the call. And they gave me a 3-week bed date, which means I have to wait 3 weeks to get in, which I thought was terrific news because I wasn't really ready to abruptly stop drinking. And my wife wasn't really ready to watch me drink for 3 more weeks. So she kicked me out and made me go stay at my parents' house till my bed date came around. And I got a little closer to my bed date, and I thought I better call this place and see what treatment's all about. I'd never heard of AA. I'd never heard of treatment. I'd never heard of anything other than stopping drinking by your own willpower. That's all I knew. And the name of this place I went to was a place called Sundown M Ranch. And so I called them and I said, "What am I supposed to bring over there? What are we going to be doing?" And, she said, "Just pack your clothes and come on over. You know, you can bring a big book or a Bible if you want, but that's it. No phones, no computers, no nothing." And I thought, what the hell is she talking about? I said, "Well, am I supposed to bring cowboy boots?" And she says, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Sundown M Ranch." I figured maybe we'd be riding horses, some campfires, a little kumbaya. I had no idea what I was getting into. And she goes, "You're out of your mind. Pack your bags with just clothes and come on over." And now I'm scared because I don't know what I've agreed to. I thought I was agreeing to a 30-day vacation. And this sounds like something different than that. And my wife was happy to drop me off there and leave me in their capable hands. And they threw me in their little detox ward and detoxed me for 3 days and then let me out into the general population. I was, as I got into the general population, I was very shocked. I'm listening to these little groups of people chat around me and they're saying things like, you know, "This is my 3rd treatment center and I'm really serious this time." And some other guy is saying, "Well, I've done this 10 times, but I'm going to make it this time." And I'm thinking, I'm never doing this again. I don't know why you would do it once, let alone multiple times, but you guys must not be real quick learners, because I'm going to figure this out and never end up here again, because this is rude. I mean, they didn't even give me my own private room. I was a little offended by that. I didn't know you were supposed to lie in treatment. So when I was asked about my life, I told him I planned on drinking again. So I was quickly voted most likely to drink again. We finally got to the 28 days. I remember Cherie coming over for family day, and I thought, she's crying and the counselor's looking very serious, and I can't figure out why everyone's so unhappy. I mean, it's not like I started drinking after we got together. She knew I was a drinker. So I'm not sure why people get so upset about some of my antics. That just goes along with drinking. And I was very confused when all that was going on, and I was probably still pretty fogged. I mean, 30 days away from alcohol, I couldn't really think straight still. But they did let me out, even though she was asking them to keep me. They let me out, and I went on my last 11-day run with alcohol. And on that 11th day, Cherie said, "Aren't you supposed to be going to AA?" She was only there a couple of days and caught that. I missed that for 30 days. I did not know I was supposed to be going to AA as my follow-up treatment. But she was aware, and I said, "Well, I don't know, am I?" And she said, "Well, they said you're supposed to." And I said, "Well, then find me a meeting," like it's her job to do that. And she did. She found me a meeting. She said, "There's a meeting right down the road in about 30 minutes. And I said, "Okay, I'll go." And I went to my first AA meeting, a little group called the Shop Group. And this old guy cornered me in the back and was telling me about how he used to drink 40 years ago and how wonderful his life is today. I could not get away from him fast enough. He had these bib overalls, kind of scared me. And then this gal came up to me, grabbed me by my face and kissed me and said, "Welcome to AA," and gave me a beginner's packet. And I was freaked out. So I left the meeting at halftime and went to finish my drunk job for the night. And I ran down and got some more alcohol. And when the when I was tipping them back on this little drive on this old country highway, my pancreas had started acting up in that 11 days. And what that means is that you puke and drink and puke and drink until you get a couple to stay down, and then you're good. So I was in the process of doing that, which is pretty rough drinking. And I caught my reflection in the rearview mirror. And I realized at that moment, I'm just as miserable being drunk as I am when I'm sober, which was a very depressing thought. I already knew I didn't want to be sober, and now I don't really want to be drunk. I did not think about running back to that AA meeting. What I thought about was hurting myself. I did not know what was next. I did not know that there was something called sober and happy. I just knew that sober didn't work, and now drinking is not working for me. I went home, went to bed, went to work the next day, and I was 12-stepped in my office by a longtime customer. And he looked at me and he said, "Are you done drinking?" And I said, "I don't know if I'm done drinking, but I'm done living my life the way I'm living it." And he said, "I got a guy I want you to meet." And he said, "We'll meet him tonight as soon as you're done with work." And so I went to dinner with him that night. Didn't drink that day, and went to dinner with him that night. And I met my sponsor, Tom Dyer. Tom's passed away. And I thought it was very rude. Tom talked for an hour and didn't ask me one thing about my life. I thought he would need to shape a very unique program for me in order to get me sober and happy. And he didn't ask me one question about me. He told me about himself. And what I learned that night was the principle of identification. When Tom told me his story, I realized that he had gone down this road a lot farther than I had. He had dug a much deeper hole than I had. And I knew by talking to him that he had found a way out, and he was way out of that hole. He was doing very well in his life at that time. And he was probably 15 years sober at the time, 15, 16 years sober. And he had put his life back together, his family back together, his business back together. And I believed all of that in that first meeting. And I think that's the magic of AA. I think that's the magic of recovery. One person talking to another person and identifying with the problem and being willing to maybe take some of the solutions. Now, I didn't know if it would work for me. I just believed that AA had worked for him. And that was enough. I was willing to give it a shot. I didn't know that I was going to get to stay sober, but I had hope that maybe if I tried what Tom said, it might work for me. And so I said, what do we do? And he said, well, we're going to meet for lunch tomorrow. Go home tonight, go to bed, don't drink, and I'll see you tomorrow for lunch. And we had lunch the next day, and he gave me my assignment, and I was overwhelmed. He was big on giving you a lot of stuff to do. I think it was about seeing who was serious about recovery and who just wanted to play around in recovery. He asked me to read some stuff every day. He asked me to call him every day. He asked me to go to a meeting every day. And then he wanted me to do some step work. And I said, this is a little extreme. You know, I'm starting to reevaluate how bad my alcoholism is at this point. I'm ready to kill myself 3 days before, but today, I think what you're asking me to do is a little extreme. He said, how many hours a day did you spend intoxicated? I said, I don't know, 12 to 15. He said, I think you can do this stuff. And I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. And when we started that journey, I never tell this story right, but I'll just tell it the way I remember it. And sure, you can clean it up later. But he did ask me, he said, you know, is there anything really bothering you, you know, that we need to talk about before you leave? And I said, sure. There's 100,000 things that are bothering me. Where do you want to start? And he goes, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, is there something that's going to cause you to drink tonight? Because it's really bothering you right now. And I said, yeah, my wife and I are not getting along, and I don't know what to do. I said, it's just a bad scene at home. And he said, well, tell me what happens. And I said, well, a typical evening might be that I will come home and I might share with her that there's some things she could clean up around the house and some things the kids could do. And she shares with me that I can go screw myself. And the evening deteriorates from there. And he goes, that's awesome. I can solve that for you right now. And I said, really? I've been trying to fix this woman forever. And you're going to help me right now? He goes, yeah, I got it. He goes, tonight, I want you to keep your mouth shut and pick up a broom. And I was dumbfounded. I'm like, I don't understand. And he said, yeah. Tonight, you're going to go home, and instead of figuring out what she needs to do, you're just going to figure out what needs to be done, and you're going to start doing it. I guess I was so shocked, I just said, whatever, and went home and started doing that. I don't know how long I was helpful in the house, but I know I quit bitching about it because I didn't want to contribute. as much in those early days. It was rough. We had a rough deal. I don't know if any of you have ever shared this with an alcoholic, but it was shared with me many times. If you just quit drinking, everything will be okay. And in our house, when I just quit drinking, everything was not okay. Our first year in recovery was worse than my last year drinking between the two of us. It was World War II. What happened is that I got my opinion back. When I was drinking, I just didn't care about anything. Do whatever you want. Take care of the bills. Let the kids do whatever they want. Didn't care. Now I care about everything. And she is a little offended that I have something to say about what's going on with the bills, what's going on with the kids. Why did you sign them up for everything there is to sign up for? I don't want to drive around all night. And we're fighting over everything. There was more holes in our walls in that first year of recovery than there was in my last year drinking. I can guarantee you that. So we had a lot of work to do. You know, the big book says that we have a long road of reconstruction ahead if you end up staying in an alcoholic relationship. And sometimes you don't have a choice. Sometimes it's with your kid. So how do we do that? And on my side, it was working the steps. And Tom took me through the steps. And we slowly... went through that process and life started to improve. I can tell you, I was somewhere in the middle of my ninth step amends. I was probably 6 or 7 months sober. I don't remember exact dates anymore. We had this Saturday morning meeting called the Hang In There meeting. Actually, it was a morning meeting. It was a Saturday lunch meeting. Started 11:30 or something like that. And my kids would fight over who got to go. I would take one kid and they could order whatever they wanted. Sweet roll, sundae, whatever they wanted. So they were always fighting about who got to go. And I had one of those kids with me and she's babbling next to me. I'm 7 months sober, headed back home. The sun's up. It's a beautiful day. And I remember thinking my first good thought in recovery is this isn't so bad. And maybe this is going to work out okay. And I just kept trudging. I just kept trudging one after another. Sheree and I have a blended family. And there are a lot of challenges with a blended family. It certainly never, our family did not look anything like the Brady Bunch family. There was a lot of who's, how much does this kid get? How much does that kid get? Don't talk to my kids that way. Don't treat my kids that way. All that kind of crap was going on in our house. And then there was all the same stuff going on with the kids. It was chaos. And we started having to work through that stuff with the kids. We would have a problem. And Sheree would say, you need to go ask Tom what we're supposed to do about this. You know, we had a kid that was slamming doors because he was angry. And that doesn't work in our house. So I finally went and asked my sponsor, you know, what do we do about this? And he said, well, give him a warning and tell him the next time he slams the door, he's going to lose his door and he won't have a door for his bedroom. I'm like, really? That sounds like fun. I'm not sure Sheree was excited about that, but I let him know. And, man, for about a year, our kids had doors off and on all over the place. We had one kid that, we used to give him time out, but we had one kid that loved time out. She hated being social with everybody. One of my kids, she'd rather be in a room. So we used to make her take her time out in the middle of the living room, drove her nuts. And all that stuff came from a sponsor. I mean, we didn't know how to do the kids. We didn't know how to do a relationship. we were just very behind the curve trying to figure that stuff out. And through the process of the steps, through the process of developing some relationships with people in the program that I loved and respected, we, you know, our lives started to shape up. Let's see, how am I doing on time? I've got a few minutes. I'll tell you one of the stories that was pretty dramatic for me. When our oldest was 18, I think, well, she was a senior in high school, whatever age she was, she started having some emotional problems. And it, to the point where she was threatening to commit suicide, right? And it became very concerning to my wife and I. She would call and say, you know, she had a plan and she's not coming home, or I'd get called to school and she's having a panic attack and can't get out of the bathroom at school, crazy stuff. And I have this deep guilt inside of me, knowing that this kid grew up with me for her first 12 years of her life. And I'm sure that some of this has been a part of why she is the way she is. But we had one night where she called me, and I just couldn't talk to her. I was too emotional, and I asked my wife to call her. And my wife called her and talked her home. And then she called me and said she's home. And man, I just broke down. And here's what happened during the middle of this process with them. I'm probably 7 years sober at the time. I started thinking about drinking again. It wasn't this idea that I want to have a couple of drinks. It's this idea I want to get rid of how I feel all the time. The scary feeling of what's going to happen to this kid, and I can't control it. And I had one of those moments where I was going to go drink, and I called my wife and I said, I'm going to go drink. And she said, okay, will you call Tom? And I called Tom and said, I'm going to go drink. And he said, okay, will you come see me first? I said, you guys are making this a little difficult, but okay. And I went and talked to my sponsor. And when Tom and I sat down, he started giving me the AABS, you know, have you prayed about it? Let go, let God. And he finally looked at me and said, this doesn't mean anything to you, does it? I said, not a damn thing. And he started crying and he walked around the desk and he gave me a hug, and man, something inside me broke and I cried and I didn't have to go drink that day. I'm never immune from this illness that I have. I get a daily reprieve. And I think if I would have been one of those guys on the edge of AA at 7 years sober, I would have been knocked off. I've always stayed in the middle of the herd. I've always had a sponsor. I've always sponsored guys, had a home group, had a service position at home group. And even with that, the waves of life continue to happen. And because of this program, I continue to stay on a path that's given us a pretty good life. Thanks for letting me share tonight.
Thank you, Matt. And our next speaker has done more service than you can shake a stick at, and she's probably done almost every service position that's available in Al-Anon, and indeed, she's probably color-coded everything. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Sheree.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sheree, and I am a very enthusiastic and grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. Thank you, Leonard, for the introduction and for the invitation, the honor to be here and just to share about our program and what a miracle recovery is. I want to congratulate the men's group for 31 years. It's pretty amazing to stick together, especially with what the pandemic has done to a lot of our groups. So to hang in there and to come back together for your anniversary night, I think that's just really special. And so congratulations for that. And happy birthday to everybody who had birthdays. Back in 2010, Matt and I decided to start a concurrent meeting with AA and Al-Anon. And part of it is because we do believe that this is a family disease and that families can get better together. And so Al-Anon would be upstairs and AA downstairs, and we'd come together on birthday nights and have an AA speaker and an Al-Anon speaker. And it has been pretty special. That group is the Families in Recovery and the Fellowship in Recovery for AA, and it's still going strong. And so appreciate the opportunity for to share that message of hope. In the very beginning, when Matt first got sober, I had the opportunity to go to a lot of open AA meetings with him. And it was there that I started to get some hope by listening to members talk about how they were applying the tools and how they were, things were changing in at work or changing with their families. And I would look at my husband wondering, when is this going to happen for us, right? I'm looking at him to be the solution. And that's what I tended to do, is that it needs to be somebody else needs to have the solution, or they need to be okay so that I can be okay. And you know, when Matt was drinking, I definitely had reached that point that step one tells us that we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives can become miserable. And I was miserable. I was that wife that was towards the end of his drinking, knowing that he was going to die. I had lost all hope. I didn't see a way out of this. I had a husband that was pretty okay about dying. And he's got two little girls from his first marriage, and I've got two little children from my first marriage. And that didn't really work in my happily ever after plans. And I am a girl that always has a plan. So we needed to do something about this so that he could get on board with my plans. So I was that wife that was telling her husband that his drinking was affecting us, that he needed to stop drinking, that drinking was the problem. Alcohol was the problem. And I did the negotiating. I did the badgering. I did the yelling. I have a memory of being on my knees one night begging him to stop drinking. And I used the words, if you love your children, if you love your girls, you'll stop drinking. And here's the thing. I know that he loves his girls deeply. He loves his girls, but alcoholism doesn't care. The disease doesn't take that into account. And I said the words, if you love me, you'll stop drinking. And I think he loved me. I'm not sure he liked me around that timeline, but I know that my husband loved me. And I know that today I can look back at that and recognize that the disease is vicious and it's cunning and baffling, like the book says. I also heard a speaker in Florida describe it as a savage master. And it definitely owned our home. It owned our family. And alcoholism perpetuated throughout our actions and our decisions. And it controlled everything that we did. And he couldn't stop drinking until that magic that happens with one alcoholic talks to another. You know, I remember going to my very first meeting. It was 3 days after my husband came home from treatment and he was in a 3-day blackout. And I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting. And I will tell you that I didn't, it was October 21st of 2001. And I don't remember much of what the member shared. I can tell you what I didn't do. I did not get a welcome packet, a newcomer's packet. I didn't get a list of phone numbers. I didn't get any literature. I didn't even acknowledge or announce that I was a newcomer. I just sat in a meeting very despondent and feeling hopeless and broken because my husband is at home drinking and I don't know what to do. I will tell you that I walked out of that meeting with a little booklet here in Washington that we call the Where and When. And it lists all of the meetings for Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the back, it had a couple of pages of the Al-Anon meetings. And so I had that meeting schedule with me so that when a week later, several days later, when Matt calls me at work and I'm like, you know, aren't you supposed to be going to meetings? And he goes, what meetings? And we had that conversation. I had the AA Where and When. And I actually had a schedule with me and I could tell him where a meeting was. And I will tell you this, when Matt was 12, stepped into AA, that is when recovery stepped into our home. It took me longer to find that recovery and that hope for myself. And it really didn't happen until I got my first sponsor. Before that happened, I just stayed busy. I just stayed involved in with the kids. I was working full time. After a while, I was able to stay home, and we decided to get involved in foster care. And I got to focus on other kids and other issues. And we ended up adopting two of those little ones that we had. So, you know, it was a busy household. We had six kids. And at the time when Matt and I got together, our oldest four were 6, 7, 8, 9. And now all of a sudden I'm adding a 2 and a 3-year-old to the bunch. And so it's, you know, in a way it sort of did look like the Brady Bunch, but I could never figure out where Alice was. So it's, I need to find a better analogy, because that just doesn't work. But we're trying to do life to the best of our ability. And I'm dabbling in Al-Anon. And what happens is that we're really not doing much better. We're not fighting around this timeline, but we're just more like co-parenting. We're partners in the house, not really caring or taking any actions to hang out with each other or invest in each other or invest in the relationship. We're just sort of muddling through life to the best of our ability. And I just stayed focused on everybody else. Around this time, Matt had a conversation with his sponsor, and Tom always had the best ideas. I utilized him as a sponsor for a long time. And Tom suggested that maybe that Matt and I could go to concurrent meetings, that he could go to an AA meeting and I would go to Al-Anon. He also suggested that we do some morning meditation time, that we read from one of our daily readers, or just spend some time in the morning with each other. And that's a little scary to me, because one, I am not a morning person, and my husband likes to get up really, really early. So we're already, this doesn't look appetizing to me whatsoever. And the other part is we don't know how to talk to each other. We don't have a common language. We just share the bare necessities of, you know, who, what, where, when, and we don't share anything intimate or be vulnerable with each other. And so that's a little scary, but we did it. I'm willing to take an action and follow Tom's lead, because he pretty much didn't steer us wrong too much. And so I'm willing to do that. And we got up in the morning and we would read The Courage to Change, or we would read from a different book from the other program. And we would say a prayer. And sometimes we got along during that timeline, and sometimes we didn't, right? It was roll the dice and we'll figure it out. But we did it. We spent mornings together with each other. And we also started going to concurrent meetings. And that's when I definitely started the practice of going to a regular meeting. I got my home group. And we would ride to the meeting together. We'd fight and argue the whole way to the meeting, and who knows what about, but I'd go upstairs to my Al-Anon group and he'd go downstairs to the AA group. And then afterwards we'd come back out into the parking lot and I'd hop into the truck, and he's nice and supportive. And he's like, you know, so how was your Al-Anon meeting? And I would just say, it's anonymous. And I wouldn't share anything. And he would ask some questions like, well, what was the topic, or what did people say? And I would say, what's said at the meeting stays at the meeting. And I would just be this snarky, unhelpful person. You know, this is who he had to deal with. But that consistency of staying connected and listening to the members and getting to know them is what changed my direction, which is what changed my attitude. That principle of identification that Matt touched on is so important. I remember sitting in a meeting, listening to a friend of mine, a dear friend who has passed away now. And she would talk about how worried and how anxious she would be waiting for her husband to come home, knowing that he's drinking on the way home, and will he make it home tonight, and how she would pace in her house. And I would sit there and I recognized that feeling. I knew that feeling. I knew that anxiety and that concern, and playing the movie in my head, the what if, you know, what's going to happen this time? Is he going to make it home? And then she would describe about how she saw his headlights coming down the driveway, and there's that overwhelming relief, you know, where you can finally just exhale. And it's like, okay, he made it home one more night. And it was like, oh, I know that feeling. I know that relief. Okay, he didn't drink today. Or he made it home and he didn't, you know, wreck the car and the girls weren't in the car, whatever that emotion was, that anxiety that I had. And then she would talk about how she would hurry and run and jump into bed and pull the covers up. And she would be so furious and so angry, and how she would plot his death, right? There's murder involved. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not the only wife that wants to kill him. Like, there's somebody just like me, right? Sitting in this room, doing the deal. And I knew her husband and I knew they had this good marriage. And so I'm like, wow, if it works for them, maybe it'll work for us. So what happens for me is I get my sponsor and I start that journey through the steps. And honestly, that's what changed how I saw myself. It wasn't about the people around me anymore. It wasn't about them that they needed to make me feel better. I knew that I needed to focus on myself. And those steps are so, so important. I'll tell you, my fourth step was probably the most impactful out of all of them. And the reason being is that I finally figured out who I was, you know, going through that fifth step with my sponsor and really identifying why I tick the way I tick. It was mind blowing to me. Come to find out, 90% of my decisions and my actions are motivated by fear. And I did not know that. I thought I was angry. I thought I was just controlling. I thought that I was a future tripper. I collected all of these defects of character, but when I really get to the root of the problem, it's fear. I'm so afraid of what's going to happen. What's around the corner? What if they do this? What if that doesn't happen? I am always planning, even though I don't know what's coming down the road. I'm going to come up with a plan. And if I can learn to turn that over to my higher power and not let my decisions be based on fear, but by the guidance of the care of God of my understanding, you know, maybe it'll look a little different and maybe I'll be a little different. I remember around this time, she had me work on, you know, all of those defects of character, and she didn't give me a lot of direction on that. But I remember that seven-step prayer and asking my higher power to remove those defects of character. And I, you know, fortunately, I had another sponsor that helped me as well talk about not only am I asking to remove those defects, but to replace them with an asset, with a quality, with something that I think God wants me to be and to act and to treat the people around us. But what was really, I think, life-changing and relationship-changing for us was around this time, as I'm starting to work on my eight steps, eight and nine, Matt and I were introduced to the traditions and relationships. And there was a couple in AA that used to give workshops actually down in California, and they lived here in Washington, and we found out about them, and Matt encouraged me to go find them. And I'm a good little doer when he delegates stuff. And so I tracked them down, and they invited us over for a day. And they went through about how they work the traditions and relationships. And so Dave and Polly P, they just, you know, poured everything into and just shared everything about their experience. And they said, you guys got this, go do this. And so they printed out, you know, information and emailed us information. And because we know that we don't do recovery alone, we asked four or five other couples in recovery to do the traditions and relationships with us. And that was about 2008 or nine, somewhere around there. It was a while ago. And every year we have done it. Every year we take another group of other couples in recovery and we go through the 12 traditions. And those traditions, you know, in Al-Anon, our intro says that they promote, our traditions promote harmony and growth. And I was so desperate for harmony in our home with six kids and, you know, my head and Matt, and then all the family members, the in-laws and the outlaws and all of that, it can get a little nutty, right? And so harmony looked attractive to me. I want to know what harmony looks like. And what I know today is that these traditions are behavior guidelines for me. They help Cherie behave better, right? How can I behave with the people that I love? And I didn't realize that I wasn't, I thought I was just loving them. I thought I was just helping them, but helping is just another kinder word of controlling, right? And really, I just want to control what they're doing and how they're doing it so that I don't have to worry about it or pay for it later. I just, let me handle it now. And our six adult children don't appreciate mom handling their lives, right? Or sharing my opinion, you know, whatever it may be. But those traditions is what changed how I started treating not only my husband, but also our family members. And that's when, honestly, Matt and I really became connected. We had a common language now, We weren't fighting. We were talking things out, even having difficult conversations. I stayed engaged. And so that, you know, years around that time when his daughter is a senior in high school and she's falling apart on us, him and I would have these conversations about how we were going to handle her and what boundaries, because she's living with us, and what boundaries is she going to, you know, follow the house rules. And she, man, she challenged us. She really tried to split us apart, and we would stand there side by side and say, you know, we're in unity about this decision. You need to go to school, or you need to not go to that party, or whatever that is that, you know, she was trying to come about what was happening. And it was a really, really scary time. I remember calling my sponsor, and she told me that I needed to up my game, that I needed to go to more meetings, that I needed to call other parents in recovery and talk about the fear that I had, because one more time I have a person that I love that wants to die and I can't save them. And so she really encouraged me to go to more meetings. So I started, I remember having the conversation with Matt saying, I need to go to more meetings. Can we work our schedule out with the kids? And I started going to 4 to 5 meetings a week and calling somebody every single day and just trying to dive deeper into my spiritual connection with my higher power. That day that I called Matt and told him that his little girl came home, I did not know that my husband was so afraid of losing his daughter. I didn't know that he was so emotional. I just remember he just fell apart on the phone sobbing. And it was like, oh, he's as scared as I am. But we just didn't really talk about, you know, the what ifs. We didn't talk about that fear. We just tried to do just today, just one day, just do the day. And that's how we handled months and months of her going through her mental health crisis. So when he calls me and says, hey, I want to drink today, I'm like, I wasn't surprised, to be honest with you. It was like, and here's the funny thing, and this is the God shot. This is the how I describe the care of my higher power, is I had just left my sponsor's house. I was spiritually fit, and I'm driving down the road and my husband calls me and says, I want a drink. And all I could say was, okay. And I know that's not what he expected. I know he wanted me to pick that fight with him, and I didn't give it to him, I guess. And he did what he did. And one more time, you know, the magic of recovery happens, and an alcoholic can identify with him and help him in a way that I can't. But what was stunning for me was the idea that his sobriety was not a given, that his recovery was not guaranteed. And so from that moment on, I have never taken his sobriety for granted. I know this disease is always there. It's always on the perimeter. And so I think that's why we encourage each other so much in our recoveries, because we know this disease is there and it will get us at any time. I want to get to the amends part before I wrap this up. That daughter of ours that was going through that mental health crisis, a couple of years later, she's in trade school, and I knew it was the appropriate time where I can sit down with her and do an amends. Her and I have always had a very contentious and difficult relationship, often not even speaking to each other. And I had this opportunity where I called her up and I told her that I had a ninth step that I wanted to sit down with her, and would she be willing to meet with me? Our 6 kids grew up in AA and Al-Anon, so they know the steps. In fact, when they got in trouble, we'd make them go with us to meetings. I remember my son got grounded one time, and I made him come to an Al-Anon workshop, and he had to set up and tear down, and he hung out in the workshops all day long. So our kids are familiar with the language and the lingo. And so when I tell her I have an amends, you know, and she's at the top of my list, would she meet with me? She said, yeah. And I was able to sit down with her and go through that list and talk to her about how I had harmed her, about some of my controlling actions, how it must have been perceived on her part, that she didn't matter, that she wasn't worth it, that she wasn't lovable, that she wasn't good enough. And none of that was true. But those are what my actions said. And even though I'm deeply sorry for that, I can't change the past, but I'm hoping that she'll give me a chance in the future. And, you know, we were at a Starbucks for that moment, and she's crying and I'm crying, and we're grabbing napkins off all the tables and having a really difficult but intimate moment. And I remember asking her, where do you see our relationship going? Do you even want to have a relationship with me? And she said, yeah. And she told me, you know, just check on me every now and then, just check on me, you know, and she's 19 at the time. And so the way to check on a teenager or a young adult is you just send text messages, right? And I would send her a text message thinking of you today. Anytime she moved into a new apartment, I would send her a housewarming gift. I always sent her cards all the time for just random stuff, but it was very at a distance, but I was present. And I just stayed that connection and just kept doing that. A couple of years later, she's been married, been divorced, and now she's going to marry husband number two. And her family is sort of in chaos about it and in controversy because her husband is 26 years older than her. She's marrying a man older than me and my husband. So we have a son-in-law that's 2 years older than us, and we call him son, and it's fun. But, you know, we got to spend some time with the two of them, and it, you know, I'm sure my husband had a different opinion than I do, but I watched her. I watched how she lit up when she was around him. I watched how he treated her. And my daughter is prickly. Like, she's very difficult. She still is to this day. And he just loved on her. He loved on her like crazy. And so I was 100% in on this one. Like, hey, this guy is awesome. You know, this might work out really well. And I remember one day she called me, and she was in tears, and she had just gotten off the phone with her mom, and some horrible things had been said. And she just says, you know, Sheree, why can't my mom just love me? Why can't my mom just support me? And I just told her, I said, honey, she loves you. She loves you, but she's probably really, really afraid for you. And she thinks that she knows best. And she's probably trying to give you advice that you don't want to hear. I said, she's not acting any different than how I used to act. I said, remember when I would say things because I'm trying to control what you're doing and how you're doing it because I'm afraid of what's going to happen down the road. I go, that's what your mom's doing. She just doesn't know how to love you the way that you need to be loved. But she's doing her best. It just feels very painful, and it sounds really horrible. And she's crying, and we talk a little bit more. And then she says, you know, she thanked me for being there. You know, she called me the evil stepmom, and she's calling me for encouragement and understanding. And she says, you know what, you are, Sheree. She goes, you're my bonus mom. And that title is everything to me. That title is the work that I have done, and the experience and the strength and hope that you guys have taught me, sitting in meeting after meeting after meeting, walking through some tough stuff with her, that I can love her right where she's at. She writes me birthday cards. She doesn't go and buy a store-made birthday card. She handwrites me one. And I got one last year, and she told me that in that birthday card that she can see the hand of God, that she sees God's fingerprints all over our relationships. And I treasure that. It's a treasure. And it's one of the things that I work really hard at with that continued amends with her, the living amends, where I continue to do things. Matt and I were just in Arizona a couple of weeks ago, spending a vacation with them. They went on vacation, and they invited us to go on vacation with them. Like, that's a miracle. And that's what being a bonus mom is to me. It's like, I get that gift of being in a relationship with that kid because of the work that I did, because she was willing to give me a chance, because I followed through with what I said I was going to do, practicing these spiritual principles. You know, I will tell you that I've heard steps 10, 11, and 12 being shared as if they're maintenance steps. And, you know, to me, they're not maintenance steps. Steps 10, 11, and 12 is where I really get an opportunity to go deeper, to grow. And, you know, my step 10 has really changed over the years. And a couple of years ago, my youngest daughter, the one that we adopted, decided she didn't want to live at home anymore. Great. I see that. Thank you. And she decided to move out at the age of 18, just graduated from high school, and is out there. Well, let me just put it that way. She's doing life on her terms. And it has been really, really difficult to watch. I spent a couple of those first several months almost being in a state of grief, like somebody had died. And then I spent several months just being really angry and in living in that obsession and consumed by anger with her. But during this time, the pandemic hit and I end up fighting a friend on Zoom, and I reached out to her and we just started a conversation specifically about this daughter and how it's affecting my relationship, or just in my head, how it's affecting my attitude. And she encouraged me to do a step 10 every day and just focus on anger, fear, and guilt. And I started doing that. And I remember she asked me to pray. She goes, "Will you pray for her?" And I'm like, "Nope." In the beginning, I was like, "Nope, I don't want to," right? I want her to feel some pain, right? I want her to feel some consequences of her decisions. And you know, my friend, she sort of laughed at me. And my daughter's pregnant at the time. And she says, "Well, can you pray for her child?" And I'm like, "Ah, like what a horrible person would I be if I can't pray for her baby?" So I started doing that. And of course, those prayers change, right? And today, my prayer is every day I wake up and I pray for my daughter. And I pray for her daughter, and that she knows that she's loved and that God gives her a hug today, you know, and that's my 10th step to stay current and stay in a place where I'm not living in anger and I'm not living in guilt. This summer, I sort of got the nudge that I needed to start a journal, and that journal is to my daughter. I have no intention of ever giving it to her. It's really just between me and God. And I write her letters periodically. Matt and I ride motorcycles, and I'll be on my motorcycle and a memory will pop in when she used to be on the back of my motorcycle. And I would write in my journal about that memory that I was thinking of her today. And with that, it keeps me connected in my step 11, that I'm having this continued conversation with the God of my understanding. And I think it's important that I continue that for me, because I know when I'm in myself and life is in session, I run amok, right? Amok, amok, amok. And I do so much better when I am searching out for God's guidance, for those answers. I really would prefer billboards, right? Billboards and neon signs, but it can come from anywhere. And honestly, it usually comes from a meeting. I'll be sitting in a meeting and one of you will share something and I'm like, "Oh, there's the answer. That's what I need to try." And all I do is try to go do that. Step 12 is carrying the message. And I think the most important part, especially what Matt and I, with where our hearts are, is we're welcoming that newcomer, welcoming the couple that comes in that doesn't know how to do marriage, doesn't know how to do sobriety, doesn't know how to do recovery. And we're like, "Welcome to the club." You know, we didn't know how to do that either. And today I will tell you, I have two meetings in person. And if a newcomer comes through the door, I'm the person that makes sure that they have that welcome packet, that they have phone numbers, that they know about our literature, that I hand them lots of more pamphlets, because I don't want them to do what I did when I first left, that I didn't have any of that information. I want them to know that there's somebody here that will listen and that will hand them the Kleenex box and that will support them in their journey. There is a favorite quote of mine, "Encouraged to Change," and I'll close with this. It is by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It says, "Place yourself in the middle of the stream of power and wisdom which flows into your life. Then without effort, you are impelled to truth and to perfect contentment." Al-Anon has helped me place myself in the middle of that stream, and that's you guys. Thanks for having me.